So in December of 2016, a man by the name of Edgar Welch waltzed into a pizza restaurant in Washington, D.C., armed with an assault rifle. He was there to self-investigate a bizarre conspiracy claim he had heard about, which alleged that Hillary Clinton and other Democratic politicians were involved in a child sex trafficking ring in the basement of that very restaurant. Much to his surprise, that turned out to be false. There was no child sex trafficking ring in the basement of that restaurant. In fact, there was no basement. As he would later tell the New York Times, the intel on this one wasn't 100%. Now, the dark fantasy that caused Welch to turn up in D.C. that day is, you know, often held up by people who work on this topic recently as the epitome of fake news, by which I mean deliberately misleading news stories spread for fun, profit, and political gain. And Welch's actions are often cited as the prime example of the harm that fake news can do. But conspiracy stories, as all of you here know, conspiracy stories like Pizzagate, as it's come to be called, is just one form, they're just one form of a broader phenomenon that would be better called information pollution. As I understand that term here, information pollution is the dumping of potentially toxic information into the media environment. And information can be toxic in a variety of ways. There's a lot to be said about that, but I'm not gonna say much about that here. I'll just say this, that some of the ways in which it can be toxic, for example, is by being false, deceptive, misleading, or simply not based on good evidence. So there's degrees of toxicity, there's lots of things to talk about there, but I'm just going to take it for granted that you have the intuitive grasp of what I mean by information. However defined, we're clearly living in a golden age for information polluters. And the talk today is gonna be about the harms that information pollution can bring, but some of those harms, I think, are ones that are, the ones I'm gonna concentrate on, I think don't receive enough attention. Now the background of why information, this is a golden age for information pollution is worth noting. It's worth noting a background condition that makes information pollution of a variety of sorts so easily spread around. And that background condition is the personalized internet. As most of you, I hope, know, everything that you read on the internet, everything you encounter on the internet, from the ads that you read on the when you're consulting the Guardian or the New York Times or what have you, to the news that comes down your Facebook feed, all of that is tailored to fit your preferences. The internet is personalized, as we say. Everything that one basically encounters on the internet has some tinge of personalization. That's how all the apps on your phone work, or almost all of them, certainly the ones that work on any standard platform. And that fact is the fact that is going to be sort of lurking in the background of the talk. I'm not going to talk about that much, but that is that fact that makes much of what is happening on the internet today in terms of information pollution effective. So Russian troll farms and research firms like Cambridge Analytica use the personalized internet to help, you know, place targeted political advertisements, as we know, and get people like and follow fake social media accounts and feed them news, which reinforce their political opinions and encourage them to perhaps, possibly, it's unclear, vote one way or another in a variety of elections. And as we all know, that's still going on, certainly in the United States. Active information pollution campaigns done by a variety of state and non-state actors going on now. occurred just a few months ago. Facebook, announced with some fanfare that it had finally figured out that, oh my God, they're shocked. Oh, fake news is going on the real platform. I'm sure they were shocked about that. None of the rest of us were, of course. So this is still an ongoing problem. It's not, by referencing 2016, I don't mean to be talking, as I'm sure you all know, about something that's just happened at one instance. It's happening now. So most people tend to assume that information pollution is wrong because it amounts to lying. So when people talk about, one of the misleading things about fake news, besides the fact that my president has now changed the meaning of that term into any news story you don't like, right? That's what fake news now means in the United States as a term. But if you think about it in its original sense, lots of people are misled by the idea that, when they think about fake news as a false news story, they tend to think that, well, what's wrong with it is it must be lying. Somebody's lying to us. And in fact, the headlines when fake news stories are uncovered as fake are often put in terms of lying. But actually, that underplays and mischaracterizes the danger. The danger isn't lies per se, but deception. And lying and deception, as many people pointed out, are not necessarily the same. When I lie, I'm saying what I believe to be false, roughly with the intention of deceiving my audience. But of course, I can deceive you without lying. Silence is a key moment, for example, can be effectively deceptive. And I could lie to you without deceiving. That may be because you are skeptical and don't believe me. That is, I lie to you, but you just, you see right through me. But it may also be because I said what I said has been inadvertently true. Either way, you're lied to but not deceived. Now, this might suggest that deception occurs when someone is actually caused to believe what is false. Deception, as we might say, is a success talent, you might think. But that's only halfway there. Deception can happen even when without false belief being the causal result. So reflect on the old con, the shell game, where somebody has three cups, right? And they have a coin or something under the cup, and the person who's doing the con is very adept at moving the cups around in a very speedy fashion, and then you're supposed to guess which cup the coin, under which cup the coin resides, or the P or whatever it is in the particular thing. The con man presents these three shells. He moves the shells around. What he's doing generally is he may be getting you to believe falsely that the coin is here rather than here. But in most cases, what's often happening is, in fact, you're not forming a belief at all. You just don't know what to think. Things move so quickly that you're befuddled. And then you make a guess. That can be a form of deception. It's common, after all. The point is to get the money from you. And I want you to keep that in mind, that analogy with the shell game in mind as we move forward. Because one of the way of understanding one of the first points I want to make is that the use of social media to spread political misinformation online is partly just a giant shell game. And when we later talk about the weaponization of information pollution, it's important to keep in mind just how it's being used and for what reasons it's being used and what end up impacting this. A propagandist doesn't generally care whether anyone or even most people really believe the specific things they are selling, although it often turns out that lots of people do. They don't have to get you to actually believe the penny is under the wrong shell. They just have to get you confused enough so that you don't know what is true. That's still deception. And it is the kind of deception that dreadful for-profit conspiracy sites and Russian-sponsored troll farms have been particularly adept at spreading on social media. No doubt some percentage of people actually believe such postings, but a far greater number of people come away ever so more slightly doubtful of what is true, of whom to trust. They just don't know what to believe or whom to trust. Now, it used to be that when someone would say something outrageously false, like the moon landing was fake, or that the earth is flat. I don't know if you know this, but in the United States, there's been a revival of flat earthism. I mean, really. But actually, why would you be surprised? Right? How could we be surprised, right? Of course there is. because they'd say, well, if that was true, I would have heard it about it by now. In fact, Sandy Goldberg, his social cosmologist, has created this important point. And what they meant was something like, well, I would have heard about it from credible independent sources, not just you, right, the person they're talking to. And they would have been assuming that there were people, credible people, editors, experts, and the like, who are sorting through various sorts of information and weeding out the bad from the good. Now, the internet has made that reasoning, sort of reasoning, moot, simply because so many of us are ensconced in our own information bubbles. Few people reject crazy claims based on the fact that they haven't heard about them before now, because chances are they already have heard about them, or something close to them, from the sites that tend to confirm their own biases. That is, when people who do hear and talk about Earth being flat, well, they don't, first of all, they don't entertain that as a crazy idea, and secondly, even if you think it is crazy, you probably have heard about it because it's come up on your social media feed, even as something to make fun of, right? So, in any event, the point that I'm making there is that the spread of information online has a way of making it more difficult for us to perhaps even reject things out of hand, because the idea that almost anything that somebody can say has been spread rather widely on the internet, and that goes for almost anything. And that can actually have the weird result of encouraging us to be more closed-minded and dogmatic, and for weirdly rational reasons. Part of being open-minded, presumably, is taking relevant alternatives to your view seriously. You look into the alternatives. If they check out, then you modify your view. If they don't, you carry on. That is, after all, just what Edgar Welch tried to do. And it was. Edgar Welch, believe it or not, he told the Times that he had not actually had an internet account when he first heard about Peacegate. He'd heard about it from some friends at a job site that he was on. And they were talking about this, you know, Hillary Clinton was involved in selling children by the slice, I guess, at his pizza restaurant, right? And he was like, wow, that sounds terrible. So he thought he should check into it. So he got himself an internet account. He did as he said. He said he did the research. He looked at the sites that his friends recommended, and there it was on this very reputable news site, 4chan. And there he saw it. And he thought, well, somebody needs to do something. What's interesting, he was being open-minded. In a sense, I'm not saying he was epistemically virtuous in other ways, but in that sense, he was doing what we would sort of think people, we like people to do. He heard something, sounded odd, he did the work. And I'll get back onto his actions later, because they were also curiously virtuous in a weird sort of way, distorted sort of way. That's all going to go away. But now notice, think about the rest of us. The rest of us know that there's all sorts of crazy stuff coming down the Facebook feed on Twitter. So this fact can mean that not only that all this craziness can mean that not only that naive people like Mr. Welch can be deceived, it means that the rest of us now need to decide which crazy stories to pay attention to and which ones to dismiss. And when they don't emerge from sources we already trust, we don't really check out the alternative. Because at least we tell ourselves there are simply too many outrageous claims out there, and that is definitely true. I mean, if you've just been following the Kavanaugh in the States right now, there's this big thing about the Supreme Court justice, now possible Supreme Court justice, sexual assault allegations against him, and in just the last 12 hours, there's been a variety of claims made, some of which I was having a hard time, I was trying to check out right here, claims. There was at least two people who are now claiming they were the person that assaulted the woman, not Kavanaugh. That's some of you who have heard that, right? I heard of the one, but apparently not the one. And, which seems to be a problem. But in any event, the point is that in these situations, crazy things, so much crazy information is happening. All of us, and I'm sure you're aware of this, you tend to go to the same sites. You're going to for doing that, as I can tell you. And many of the cases of people here, those will be good reasons. But that's got to be one of the saddest ironies in a time rich with them. The technology that allows us to know more than ever before, faster than before, the technology we carry around in our pockets can also turn us into closed-minded dogmatists. And not just because it's inflating our information bubbles and not bursting them, but because it's causing us to feel like we need to dismiss more and more alternatives to our views simply because we don't even have the time to investigate them. There's too many alternatives available. All right. So these first remarks that I've made have been an attempt to try and point out some of the obvious harms, deception, confusion that information pollution can cause. People are confused, they don't know what to believe, they become maybe more closed-minded, possibly they're being lied to. Those are the more obvious harms of information pollution. Harms that are, you know, being inflicted upon us by actual agents. Now I want to move into the type of harm I think is less obvious and the one that I want to talk about in depth. So information pollution is not a new phenomenon. It has always been and will continue to be the chief weapon of the propagandist. For it is by the use and misuse of information that those who desire to manipulate hearts and minds have always acted. And the purpose of that action is almost invariably the same: to rouse passions of the ordinary citizen and to instill a dogmatic and unforgiving attitude with regard to some thought, ideology, or strategy. For it is by instilling some attitude, some passionate attitude, mental attitude, that people can be made to do the most inhuman things to each other. That is the case in totalitarian regimes, and it is the case in contemporary liberal democracies, where propaganda, while necessarily different in character, is no less effective. Yet the term information pollution also can be misleading. The metaphor assumes that the broader information culture being polluted, like nature, is already given, and say for the interventions of polluters, pure. And that's first, I now want to note that that is definitely misleading. It's misleading because it is we humans who make and convey information, and it is we who construct and live in the wider information culture. The internet is not just something that has happened to us. It's a world we've created, and as every good propagandist knows, one can't seize hearts and minds without appealing to something that is already hidden deep within them. And so it is with fake news and information pollution. We've created a digital world that reflects our tendency to care less about the truth than we profess, while it encourages us to be more arrogant in our tribal convictions, sort of foreshadowing what I might go on to say. And so I think there's a way of thinking about the right term we might need to describe our present media culture, and by that I mean particular in this talk, our social media culture, is not information pollution, but corruption. So corruption is not the same as pollution. Pollution is something that happens to a system. Corruption is something that happens within the system. One way, and I emphasize only one way, this is not an analysis of corruption, is one mark of corruption. Is when the system is corrupt. One way of it being corrupt is when its stated rules are not the actual rules that it operates under. So, for example, a judiciary system is corrupt when its stated rules of treating everybody equally under the law are not the actual rules that it's operating by. When, for example, bribes are common. All right? There are other ways for systems to be corrupt, obviously. In a way that I'm going to go on to argue, I think that there is a clear sense in which our present social media culture, the one that I engage in, is corrupt or can be corrupt in the way that I just sketched. That is, and in particular, what we might call its epistemic rules. The epistemic rules
information is traded, distributed,
consumed,
and produced in this on these platforms. The epistemic rules that we think we're operating under are not the actual epistemic rules that are in fact operative beneath the surface. In order to warm you up for that, let's return to the pizza games example. This is a small example. I'm going to talk about our ordinary life online in a moment, but let's talk about pizza games. So that story was very specific. It was a very specific story. Hillary Clinton, like conspiracy stories in general, for those of you who've thought about them, you realize that when marked by a true conspiracy story is that it's overwhelming specificity. And this was an extremely specific conspiracy theory. It was a particular restaurant, not just any pizza, you know. It was a particular restaurant on a particular street, owned by real people. That was where it was supposed to be happening. Right? It was widely circulated, the story. But by the time Mr. Welch pulled his Chuck Norris act, so it was widely circulated. Lots and lots of people talked about it. Alex Jones of InfoWars, a dreadful character in the United States, a conspiracy theorist who has a big following, talked about it at great length. So, but what were people doing? Well, there were a lot of death threats. So a lot of the restaurant owners got death threats. It was terrible for them, right? Because people call up and say, you know, you gotta stop selling children with your pizza. We on to you, right? Okay, and they would say nastier things. And then also, bizarrely, restaurants along the block also got death threats. It wasn't really clear why that was, but I guess just, I don't know, better safe than sorry or something. maybe they're all doing it. And there were a little protest, except the protest tended to be like just one or two people standing outside with signs. Now, this is a widely circulated story, okay? Not like hidden in the dark corners of the internet, widely on the surface. Lots of people profess to believe it. Actual, real politicians actually floated possibility of checking into this story. So the sort of Chuck Norris act, as I call it, Mr. Welch, though, was the first time he heard about it. And he thought, I need to check this out. So he actually got a gun and thought, well, I need to do something about it. Now, why he thought that was a good thing as opposed to, let's say, calling the police, I'm not sure. Or why no one else would call the police. Apparently, from what I could tell, doing some research, really, they didn't really get a lot of complaints. Which sort of shows that something weird is going on, isn't it? Something weird is going on. Something is not right. People are. And then, what a very interesting thing. Right? I think more interesting was the reaction within certain far-right media circles immediately following Mr. Walsh's attack. Because he went in, and he looked for the basement, and he made the employees open a door which he thought led to the basement, and it was just a closet. And then he realized there was no basement. And so he put down his gun, and he came back out, and he held up his hands. Right? He's arrested. He's like, well, as he said, it was not 100%. what are you going to do? try your best. But right afterwards, in far-right media circles, something that's now become very familiar in the United States has happened. There were a flurry of tweets like this one, and I'll read it off. This is from a fellow, a real guy, Jack Prozebeck, who's still happily disseminating false information all over the internet. And he tweeted out, confirmed. This is what that tweet says. Confirmed, all caps. Comet Pizza Gutman, Edgar Madison Welch, is a actor. That's also in caps. And this got spread around very quickly, that actually Welch was an actor recruited by the very same conspiracy people that were selling the kids, right? And they had changed the building. But what's interesting about that is that this guy, Jack Prozebeck, was one of the most active people, along with Alex Jones, talking about this conspiracy theory on this social media.
shared by thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. Okay, and right after the guy does this, he says, well, that was an actor. Why is that interesting? Because this guy also was a projects director, he called himself, of a group called Citizens for Trump. Provided a very weird spectacle, this tweet and others like it. Those who had supported the Pizzagate theory almost instantly began claiming that the man who had really followed up on the story, the one man who had followed up on the story, was actually an actor paid for by a liberal conspiracy. And then so go conspiracy theories, you might say. There's no getting around their craziness. But this is a bit different. It was almost as if the Trump supporters who had insisted they believe the story now wanted to label that very fact. Seemingly believed it, or said that they did, as fake news. And in fact, they did. They started to claim that they had never said these tweets, even though they were there on public record. In fact, in many cases, like Rosenberg, didn't even delete his tweets. It's bizarre. They wanted to deny that anyone like them would act on a story that they constantly said required action. And this was indeed a theme of the tweet. You can check this out. The constant theme. Drumroll, somebody has to do something. Somebody has to do something. Children are at risk. But yet when somebody did something, that's absurd. No, why would anybody do anything? They must have been an actor or a crazy person. I think that this shows that there's an element of self-deception in our work, in what we're doing online. We're not just, part of the danger is not just deceiving, the deception that can be wrought on you by information polluters. It also shows that to some degree, we seem to be playing by different rules than we've ever played by. Now, in the case of Mr. Prozbak and the other conspiracy theorists, that's, again, fairly obvious why I started with that case. It's less obvious when it comes to the rest of us, but more important. Okay. So now I want to move into my main case I want to make. So one of the things that people like Prozbak, but also people like you, if you do, not all of you are going to use social media, I understand that. Some of you will not. Good for you. But for the rest of us, including myself, one of the things that you do on social media, if you don't use it, take my word for it, is to share news stories. In fact, it's one of the most common ways in which people politically engage on the internet, whether it's Twitter or Facebook or any variety of other sites. News stories are shared online quite a bit for political purposes. And of course, this is what makes social platforms so appealing to troll farms, of course. But let's focus on what we're doing when we're sharing news stories. All right. So one thing you can talk about of a share. So take a share. So here's you can take real ones like stories. I just shared a story online about news that updates about the Lacey Ford's testimony that just happened. I shared some on Facebook. You could take that. Or you could take a fake news story like one that I ran across one once, which was revealed Hillary Clinton is really working for the Russians. Whatever it is, just let's say it's X is F. So take a news story, the headline of which is a declarative claim like X is F, right? Or X is some ordinary comment, all right? Now, the act of sharing that story, I'm going to claim, could be understood as a communicative act. It's not a linguistic act, except unless you want to be very permissive in your use of the term linguistic. All right? But it is a communicative act. Because communicative acts of communication, are obviously not just verbal, they're not just linguistic. They can be visual, they can involve pictures, drawings and stick figures or pointing. And as we all know, these can come in a variety of
American, so we do more than one thing at a time, such as when I say that some food at a restaurant is tasty, or I say that, you know, food at that restaurant is tasty. And if I say that in the context of where, when we're wondering where to go for dinner, I probably form at least two actions of communication. On the one hand, or linguistic acts, I assert, or seem to assert, that food at that establishment is tasty. And at the same time, I also endorse it as the place that we ought to eat. Right? So there's, you know, because it's in the context of us wondering where we got to go for dinner, I gesture at the restaurant, I might even just nod at it, say the food, that place is tasty. Well, I've asserted one thing, but I've also endorsed, whereby endorsement, I mean, I've asserted another claim with an op-ed. All right. You might now see where I'm going. I want to claim that acts of sharing news stories are communicative acts. And these acts, like any other acts of communication, should be understood as being capable of doing a number of different things at once, or put it more carefully, that we can do a number of different things with one act of sharing a story online. Now, when we share a news story online, especially when we do so without comment, which data shows is almost always, most of the time, most people who share things do not comment, they just share it. When we do that, we typically appear to others and ourselves to be doing something similar to the example of the restaurant, that the food at that restaurant is tasty. We appear to be engaging in one or both of the following communicative acts. One thing we appear to be doing is engaging in an act of testimony, that is, asserting that something is the case. So one thing we could be doing when we say that, when we share this story with that headline, is we could be not strictly speaking asserting, because we're not asserting, I think, strictly anything, but we're doing something that sort of we might call quasi asserting. In any event, whether or not you like the notion of extending the notion of assertion like that, it certainly seems like we're engaging in an act of testimony. And what are we testifying to? Well, that X is F, right? So that's one of the things that we seem to be doing. We don't have to be doing that, but it's typically, we take ourselves, if I share some story, Trump is a liar, I feel like all the stories, I seem to be saying Trump is a liar. Now, I could also be doing something different. I could not be doing that, and I could be doing something. I could be instead endorsing. I could be not testifying to X is F. I could be endorsing or recommending some piece of information, saying it is worthy of attention or possibly even belief. We may even just say this in a comment, and if we do comment on the post, we might even say that. We might say, everybody needs to read this. So another thing we could be doing is saying, something along that order. Right, that's just an example. I mean, you could endorse, you could, many odd claims that you might be attempting to make. All right? My point being is that I'm trying to build the case that on the surface, I emphasize that, so that you might get to see this coming. On the surface, it seems that what we're doing when we're engaging, sharing news stories, is doing something like what we're doing when we say the food in that restaurant is tasty. Okay. Now, of course, sometimes we aren't actually endorsing the story. There are lots of exceptions. We are sharing it only as something that we think is amusing or really dumb or ironic. And when we do something like that, the kind of act we're engaging in is self-consciously expressive. We are expressing our amusement or ironic detachment or frustration. We might not be stating anything. We're just expressing our amusement. We aren't trying to convey anything with factual descriptive content. Even if you take, you know, if you think that Mark might be really strong on the surface, descriptive content. evidenced by the fact that most people feel obligated to signal one way or another that their act of sharing shouldn't be understood as an endorsement. When you share something that you don't agree with, this is a general rule of how people interact online, when you share something that you don't agree with, that you think is misleading or false, even if you think it's funny, you often try to find some way, maybe a contextual way, to signal that that's the case. That's how it works. On Twitter, for example, the contextual way is that it's not uncommon for people to declare on their profile page that retweets are not endorsements. People will put that on, you know, it's like a blanket thing. Like, I'm going to retweet stuff, but don't come back and blame me if it turns out that X is not F, not my problem. Right? And of course, that wouldn't make sense as a default assumption if, you know, if the default assumption wasn't that, of course, retweets are endorsements. Otherwise, people wouldn't care. So it's pretty clear what, I mean, it's been well studied, and it doesn't require fancy, fancy social science, I suppose, in a way. It just needs to go on there and experience the world, and you'll see that that's the case. So shares typically seem to us like assertions and or endorsements of assertions. Again, typically. And again, on the surface, we seem to treat them that way. But what if that appearance is just that, appearance and not reality? What if we are just confused about the way communication actually functions online in this case? As it turns out, there are reasons, I think, to think that this is so. All right. These reasons have to do, on the one hand, with what we do and what we don't do with the content that we share online. So let's start with what we don't do. What we don't do, it turns out, is read it. Some of you will not be surprised at this at all. Some others of you may be shocked. Current research estimates that at least, for example, 60% of news stories shared online are not even read by the person sharing. In 2016, researchers at Columbia, for example, reached this result by cleverly studying the intersection of two data sets. The first was made up of Twitter shares over the course of a month from five leading news sites, as tracked by tweets containing the bit.ly links. That is, doesn't matter. The second set of data was comprised of the clicks over the same period connected to that set of shortened links. So first they're tracking the shares, and then they're tracking the clicks. So these sets were massive. 2.8 million shares, responsible for 75 billion potential views. Potential views, interesting question on how they got that. It's not our concern at the moment. And almost 10 million clicks, that's pretty easy to tell. Right? So those are massive data sets. Really, really big, by any standard. After designing a methodology for sorting through these correlations, which is really what's cool about the study, and correcting for its biases, which is also cool, what they found was that only 4 in 10 people tweeting out news items had actually read them. And it may go farther than that, and here, and this is an anecdote. So I was at an event at the National Press Club, and at this event, it was operating by the rules that this other event, old Michael Powell, where we were allowed to speak, we're allowed to talk about what happened, but not to accredit it. But I will say that a senior social media executive said to the group that their own internal data showed their own internal data, as he claimed, was actually much worse than this Columbia study. He was talking about Columbia study. Their own internal data showed that up to 90%. Was interesting questions about how, in both studies, what constitutes reading and things like that, right? Those are different questions. But it turned out, in the case of the Facebook's own internal stuff, it was really just clicking through and spending, and they could tell how long you were on the page, and it was just a few seconds, really. So reading just meant like, you know, not really reading, what we would consider reading. So I don't know whether, you know, I can't say that that's, you can't verify that claim. You can't verify the Columbia one, you can look at that study. If either of those two claims, another variety of other studies, are right, it seems to indicate that the news is not good. We're basically not reading Marsha Shane. Most of the time. Most of the time. And if the Facebook data is correct, almost no one is. Now, as a side note, it won't surprise any of you here that the Facebook executive also said that there was no way they were going to publish that. Right? Why would they underline the business model? That's what we don't do. We don't read what we're sharing. So I want you to think about that data, that result. What we do do, on the other hand, when we share content, is we share content that gets us pissed off and riled up. Researchers at the University of Pennsylvania, for example, found that the best predictor of sharing, best predictor that a particular item will get shared widely, is the strong emotions associated with the content, displayed in the content. Words, strong emotive words. And that includes emotions or pictures, of course. Pictures are part of this, of course, a large part of it. Like affection, so think about fluffy kittens, right? Those strong emotions attached to, you know, the awe feeling, right? That's very good for predicting sharing. Again, like none of us are surprised, right? But the other emotion that they found was really particularly salient is, and this will again perhaps not surprise you if you think about it, is outrage. An NYU study suggests, for example, that morally latent emotions are particularly effective. That is an object, but, and of those, again, the morally latent notion of outrage. In fact, every moral sentiment in a tweet increases by 20% its chances of being shared, and particularly negative moral assessments. And as the neuroscientist Molly Crockett at Yale's work indicates, social media actually tends to increase our feelings of outrage, acts that would not elicit as much, in fact, in her study, don't elicit as much outrage offline, actually elicit increased levels of outrage online. Really interesting work. Now, Crockett has noted this may be due in part to the fact that social benefits of expressing outrage online, such as increased tribal bonding, still exist. Right, so when you express outrage, Crockett says, and I think she's got a good point, in a group, in your tribe, and you're, you know, outraged at something, that can serve, along with a lot of other morally important emotions, to bind the tribe together. And that can happen in online as well. But one thing that doesn't happen as much online are the costs of outrage. In real life, when you get outraged for the person on the bus, right, you stand up and yell at them, they might yell back or hit you, right? There's a risk, right? We know that, right? You think before you get outraged in person, but there's no risk online. There are less risks. There's less risk. There are risks, but they're not as immediate. Moreover, lots of research has shown that outrage feels good to people. Norway. Makes people feel good. Angry, but certain type of dopamine receptors are activated. So that's interesting because our digital platforms are designed to maximize shares and eyeballs on posts, and outrage does that. So it's not surprising that perhaps that it is a great, the internet is a great mechanism for producing and encouraging the spread of outrage. It's, and social media, we might say, is an outrage factory. As Crockett puts it, if moral outrage is like fire, then social media is like gasoline. Now, put together these points. What we're doing with our shares is not, what we're doing with our shares and what we're not doing. Well, I think if you put those together, I think it makes it difficult for us to believe that the primary function of our communicative acts are really to make assertions or to make what I'm calling endorsements, that is, assertion, at least things that, you know, complicated problems in
ethics that are associated with awesome.
But even though that's typically what we think that we're doing, and again, remember, retweets are not endorsements. We think we're doing one of these things, typically. But the data that I just suggested seems to me to require an explanation. I think there is an explanation. The explanation is that we're not trying to share online to transfer knowledge. We're not actually, the primary function of that act is not to to engage a testimony or even endorsement. The primary function of sharing content online is to express our emotions. And in particular, when it comes to local news stories, we often share them to display our outrage, broadcast it, and to induce it in others. Now, the reason I talk about a primary function, or what we might call a proper function, is what I mean by that is that roughly that a communicative act's primary function is that which sustains the use of the act, that kind of act. That is why that kind of act continues to be employed by communicative agents. That's the primary function. In other words, a kind of communicative act could have a primarily expressive function, but of course also sometimes be used descriptively. That's fine. What I'm talking about is the primary function. What sustains the practice of sharing? What sustains the practice of sharing is not that we are learning things from each other, or even, in fact, trying to get each other to learn things. What we're doing, what sustains it, is the fact that we are expressing our emotions. It's very useful for that. Expressions of emotions like moral outrage, are how tribes are built. How social norms are enforced. And this outrage factory that social media is works because most folks aren't aware of that fact or don't want to be aware of that fact. And it is this lack of awareness, presumably, that trolls and the fake news industrial complex, such as it is, find so useful. Purveyors of fake news are keenly aware, suggest, of what we're doing when we share. And they're at least, if they're not aware of the theory that I'm pulling out, philosophers after all, they are aware that what we're doing is not what we think we're doing. And I think that, once that sort of is laid out, it's easier to manipulate people and get certain results if they are they think that they're playing by a certain set of rules, but they're actually playing by a different set of rules. So philosophers from Hume and Wittgenstein have pointed out, I'll just summarize this point. I mean, the sort of long digression about the semantics here, and what I'm essentially claiming is, to put it bluntly, if you want, so in this section I say, well, expressivism, yada, yada, this seems to be a sort of simplified version of expressivism. I say that that's the case, essentially trotting out old-fashioned AIR-style motivism and saying, well, seems to work for the internet. And then I say, but I don't, I'm not endorsing it, right? These are not endorsements. For moral language in general, I'm not an expressivist, I'm not moral language in general. What I'm saying is, if you wanted to know how old-fashioned expressivism, what the world would look like if old-fashioned expressivism was true, look at Facebook. Sorry, I had to try that. But when I give this talk in a different venue where there aren't philosophers or academics, I can't say that. Nobody knows what that means. But for me, it's fine. okay. And it's fight words, I'm sure, to some people. Okay, so, all right. Okay, various qualifications, yada yada, entertaining objections, scale over all that. So, consider, let me mention one sort of, so I have like a couple more minutes?
Yeah.
So consider a thought, let's end with a thought experiment. Imagine that it's, so in order to set up a thought experiment, I need you to, if you don't know Facebook, I'll tell you something important about it. So on Facebook, it used to be the case that when you share a post or you made a post, people could react by either giving it the thumbs up, well, giving it the thumbs up, they could give it the thumbs up or not, right? Nowadays, you can give it the thumbs up and you have little emoticons, little happy face, angry face, well, it's like outrage face, really, and so forth and so on. Sad face, laughing face. So you have these emoticons. And that's how Facebook regulates how you react to posts. Right? Emotionally, that's how it goes. Now, imagine that. I once did suggest this to a different Facebook representative, which they found it very amusing. I said, imagine that you instead had, I said very earnestly, you had, only epistemologists would think this would be a good idea, that instead of having the emoticons, you had certain buttons that were like, justified by the evidence, not justified by the evidence, need more information. I was like, why do you guys do that?
Yeah, well, he soon found that he had other things to do.
But actually, when you think about it, what you realize is that even if they did do that, if what I've been claiming here is right, that we've been playing, we think we're playing under one set of epistemic rules, that is the rules of justification and testimony online, and we're actually not playing by those rules at all, because we're not playing the truth app game at all. If that's true, then changing buttons wouldn't mean a thing. I mean, people might at first be like, oh yeah, huh. You know, they might be more inclined to just say, need more information, which would be fine by me. But pretty quickly, don't you think, if I'm right, that justified by the evidence would start to have an emotional balance. It would be more like, yay that. Go girl. Right? Not justified by the evidence, like, angry face. That's not justified. That's empirical about this. We could try it. Yeah, not successful getting anybody to do it for me, but, maybe somebody would be able to do it. Yeah, even in the way of thought experiments, this one is idealized. It's idealized, of course, the one I just went, but it highlights a crucial point. We don't typically react to news stories shared online in the way that we do information shared by another person. Or a person either on the street or in a courtroom or in a newspaper. Say, claiming a newspaper. That's no surprise, of course. Facebook and Twitter weren't designed to be news platforms. And they aren't. Although that's what, in fact, as I'm sure you know, most people in the world claim they get their news from Facebook. By overwhelming margin. What does it tell us? Well, it tells us we're creating a world of illusion, but we're choosing to live in it, all the while complaining that our critics